Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast about the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is special guest Ben Lang, the co-founder and executive editor of Rote VR. Hello, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. And of course, beaming in from Germany, we have Mr. Peter Leckoff.
Hello, everyone. And a weird story once again. I'm sitting right now on a Starbucks right after Augmented World Expo. So if you hear any baristas or coffee falling down, I'm sorry. It's just the ambient noise that I have to deal here. But at least I'm mobile.
Yeah, you're really proving out our in VR podcasting model to see if this works. Yeah. I like it. All right, guys. So if you've listened to the podcast or if you've been in the VR industry, you've probably read one or two or many articles from Rote VR. And Ben, you are one of the founders of this site, and you guys are probably one of the most informed kind of journalists in VR and AR space. Let's kind of begin with how did you come around to being exposed to this industry? And then how did Rote VR, how was that founded and why?
Sure. It's a great question, and it's a somewhat interesting story. So it's funny that you say, how are you exposed to the industry? Because when I started, nobody would have ever used the phrase VR industry. I mean, it was in between this era where, you know, VR had sprung up and shined bright in, you know, 80s and 90s, and really kind of died completely in the consumer space, although it hung out in a couple little niche areas. It was between there and this rebirth of VR that I started Rote VR. So it was 2011, which is a year before Oculus went to Kickstarter, several years before they were bought by Facebook. I was doing technology journalism prior to that, writing about mostly mobile technology, you know, writing for some other people as a contributor. And I was kind of just ready to start something on my own. You know, I had a couple of years of experience under my belt. I felt like I'd learned a lot about the things that I was writing about, and came to realize that through years of writing about a topic, I had learned so much about it. But that topic wasn't, you know, super exciting to me anymore. It was kind of a mature technology. And so I was looking for something new, to kind of engage my writer's interest, if you will. So I figured if I'm going to be potentially, you know, starting something on my own, I should pick a topic that is interesting to me because I'll end up learning a lot about it. So at the time when I started Rote VR, it was not like, hey, here's a business idea. It was a passion project. It was just a passion hobby, really. So it was 2011. I literally had a list of several different topics, you know, that I was interested in writing about. And
what else was on
virtual,
it?
There was a couple things. I remember astronomy, maybe astrophotography specifically. So I do a little bit of amateur astrophotography. I thought I could learn a lot about that if I were to be writing about it. I was potentially going to be thinking about doing kind of a more of a niche blog for users of a specific popular device back then, a tablet. Tablets were pretty new. Virtual reality was on there, and probably a couple others. But virtual reality was on there just because I was just interested in it conceptually. You know, I would lay awake at night on some of those nights that you do where you think about random things and just think, you know, virtual reality, as inspired by science fiction, you know, movies like The Matrix, you know, it's this idea that if you can have all of the external stimuli created internally, essentially, you know, that you could recreate a world that seems real. And the idea that that might actually be physically possible to create a reality that is as perfect as, you know, something shown in The Matrix just fascinated me. And I wanted to figure out, you know, is that possible, first of all? And how far away are we from that, if it is? So that's kind of the origin of the not only the site, but the name Rote to VR. It was me wanting to kind of map out this roadmap toward a potential future where humanity is able to build a perfect recreation of virtual reality, not like what we have today, which is incredibly crude compared to that, yet fascinating. So it was 2011. I started just reading and writing. I knew nothing about VR aside from, you know, what I'd learned from pop culture, really, and the occasional, you know, whatever article here or there, things that I picked up from, you know, what had happened in the kind of 90s scene. I just started reading and writing to learn and figure out where things were going.
What indicated to you that VR was something that was kind of right around the corner? Because you were saying Oculus hadn't even announced yet, or they hadn't been acquired. Like, I don't remember hearing about VR up until that initial Oculus Kickstarter video with like Gabe Newell, and it made its rounds on Reddit. But yeah, why was VR even on the list of things that you could potentially focus on?
Sure. So, I believe I started Road to VR before Oculus was formally formed as a company, and it was about a year before the Kickstarter itself. So I had no conception, neither did, I don't think, anybody else. You know, even the guys who ended up forming Oculus, I don't know if they knew it was even going to, you know, VR would be where it is today this fast. But it was on that list for one because of that just raw interest that's kind of always stuck with me. And for two, coming out of that mobile computing space, I had a sense that some of these technologies were coming together that might make VR, you know, a possible thing in the near future. So in particular, I think that was a lot of the new at the time natural human computer interaction stuff. So touchscreens were over the, you know, last couple of years shown to be very, very natural, very intuitive for interacting with computers. Voice input, you had the Kinect, you had the Wii in the, you know, these years prior. And I started to see that computers were starting to understand kind of humans more as humans, as opposed to us having to adjust ourselves to help the computer understand us. And that helped build upon this idea of, you know, where is VR today? Where did it go? You know, it used to be around, and then no one's been talking about it really at all. And then also at the time, there was like, there were some head-mounted displays out there. There was one or two really kind of modern consumer headsets you could buy, but they were not what we'd call VR headset today. They didn't have head tracking. They were basically glorified video players. But as I started to dig into this, I started to see that people were hacking these things together, stick a head tracker on top to see what that would look like. And just, as I said, you know, kind of learned and immersed myself in the subject matter to figure out what was going on. Now here we are, we just passed our 7-year anniversary recently. I brought on my co-founder, Paul James, who's been working with me for years now, Scott Hayden, one of my primary writers, and we're right along with the industry here, just growing, and it's wonderful.
Congratulations, and I hope you never feel at that point where you're like, the road to VR has been reached. It's as saturated as mobile phones are, and we don't perhaps need to, we don't need to keep trying to map out them a roadmap.
I have a strange question. How often have, you know, business people approached you and said, ooh, it's time to change the name to Road to IR?
Oh, God.
I've definitely heard jokes in that direction. I have heard people say, you know, things like, hey, you know, the road's over, VR's here. And, you know, my answer to that brings me back to kind of the core of what I'm doing, of why I'm doing what I'm doing, which is, you know, the thing that I was looking at from the very start before, you know, I knew I'd ever be using VR headsets in the near future was this idea of a perfect virtual reality. And that was really reinforced to me by the fact that I lucid dream on occasion, which for anybody who doesn't know is a dream where you kind of have a sense that you're dreaming and are able to control it in a certain way. And it just deeply fascinated me that our brains are able to self-stimulate to create a world that feels real that we can even consciously control to an extent. That for me was kind of the proof that a perfect VR, a perfect virtual reality or something near to it, it's not ridiculous. Like, it should be possible. But I do think that is probably won't happen in my lifetime. I don't think that we'll see perfect virtual reality in the next 100 years. And that means I have great job security because the road to VR will be very long. I think longer than somebody looking at the technology today might expect based on where we are.
Is that really the barrier that we're trying to pass through, though? Like, I think perhaps I did think along those lines as well until maybe a few years ago when I realized, like, the utility that you get from something that is not, let's say, 100% realistic, or the utility is not directly tied to its realism, right? Or even your the full immersion aspect. Are you 100% immersed or not? Doesn't mean you can't get utility out of a podcasting app or out of a computer, you know, desktop app. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like people, maybe the name of virtual reality always gets people to really think about like immersion and presence and photorealism to be like the raison d'etre of the technology existing, rather than thinking about the human computer interaction just being more natural and being able to understand the user's intent better than try to create like a reality.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. VR doesn't need to be the perfect virtual reality in order for it to be useful. I mean, look at what we're doing right now. This is incredibly awesome. We're sitting in virtual reality. We're having a conversation. I've got my computer in front of me that I'm controlling. Even if this wasn't super immersive, and frankly, it's pretty immersive. I'm looking at you guys and gesturing naturally and all this stuff. Even if this seems primitive, 10 years from now, it's incredibly useful, and it's a valuable technology, immersion or not. This idea of the perfect virtual reality is more of a broad kind of philosophical thing, which is an element of the passion. But of course, here we are in the nitty gritty, actually using this technology and talking about it, reviewing it. But that philosophical concept, it kind of feels like. Aside from colonizing the stars, if humanity is able to create a technology that can offer realities that feel 100% real, I mean, what are your limits? At that point, it's literally your imagination, right? If you could create that that it feels 100% real, so that you couldn't actually tell it wasn't real, you can do anything. I mean, that's the nearest thing that I can imagine. Humanity would ever come to something like heaven. Right, that's pretty spectacular, especially because the dreams, the lucid dreaming and things like that, give us that little glimpse to think it might not be insane that's possible. And that, as I guess a geek in this area, just will never not be interesting to me.
Yeah, and just to think that Road to VR might have been called Road to the Stars or Road to, like astrophotography is what it could have been. So I guess we can transition more towards like recent kind of understanding. We've been looking at the last 4 or 5 years of VR, and it's honestly, it's crazy to think from when we started the podcast 2.5 years ago to where we are now, and how. Ah, man, just the feelings and the momentum of the industry have really, I think, gone into like at least the first and second gear. And I guess since we have you here, it's worth analyzing what is happening today and to be able to also like make predictions for the future. A lot of our audience and our listeners are developers in the field, just academics and researchers that want to be investing their time and their skills. So it's, I think, really valuable for them to hear analysis. So I guess one thing we haven't spoken too much about is Oculus Quest and kind of where that fits in this world. And then I see it as kind of like the pivotal shift between the high-end VR, the desktop VR that I don't think is going to go away. Similarly to like, I think you can make a comparison between consoles and PC gaming, where PC gaming seems like it's really not going to die, and that even is a growing field. But there's the audience for console gamers are very, very different. What do you think is the audience going to be that different for Oculus Quest, and how do you think the content will be also different for them as well compared to what is being built for Rift and Vive? Let's just start with Oculus Quest, with your experience with it and what you think. Kind of, will it make a big impact when it's launched, or is it just going to have a long tail of sales and content that'll come out?
Sure. I think it will have a big impact. So Kind of the dirty little secret, or maybe not so secret, of VR is a lot of reports and projections and all these things have been oftentimes referencing, or at least some of the worst ones that I've seen. There are some good ones out there, but have oftentimes been referencing not only all the Gear VRs that are out there, but also cardboard headsets. And the truth is, people just really aren't using those devices very much. There were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Gear VR headsets given away as pre-order bonuses for Samsung phones, a couple years ago. And that's why a lot of those devices are out there. So although developers and oftentimes people working in like 360 media and that kind of stuff are seeing that as like, oh, there's a big big base out there, I don't see a lot of people, knowing this space, talking to people who use these products. I do not see a lot of people regularly using a headset like that and coming back to it. It's still a novelty. And a lot of that, I do think, is the fact that we don't have, there's not the, the content library, of course, but that's enabled in many ways by these input capabilities that we have on the high-end headsets that make for really rich experiences. It's really cool that we have Go here, which is, easier to use, more affordable because you don't need the specific phone. So it sounds like, Peter, you might chime in there.
Yes, just for the audience, whenever I'm trying to say something, I turn on the mic and then the rumble comes in. The Gear VR, I partly would agree with you, but when I actually bought the Oculus Go, mostly for podcasting, I actually figured out, oh, I actually start to use it more often. Like, I ended up playing a lot of games and really have a lot of fun. And in a sense, the library and the richness, what you can do with Oculus Go, is based on the fact that, Samsung was promoting so much the Gear VR. Everyone was expecting that, there will be a market, and developers created actually pretty great content. So, even when you go those days through the comments of most popular apps on the Oculus Go store, you still see that a lot of people are commenting from their Gear VR. So I think you have a good point that, the Gear VR never caught a moment where you're like, yeah, I have a Gear VR, let's get a 1-2 and let's have fun. And like, yeah, and except maybe the really hardcore fans, no one was like totally bragging about having a Gear VR. And it was also a hustle to put a phone in. But in a sense, it prepared what the Oculus Go is made of, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that is a good point. And it's not to say that these aren't, good devices in certain spaces. They're not junk. They did pave an important path. So Go is great now, though, because it is a more usable device that is leveraging that existing library that was built up and by developers who were excited at what was coming. But there is this divide in the content between those platforms, between Gear and Go and other 3DoF headsets and the high-end stuff, which typically your high end is mostly just qualified by whether or not it's 6DoF. The rendering power, two hands and 6DoF on head and hands is what I meant to say. So the rendering power is in some ways, irrelevant. You can think about that like between smartphone and gaming, or I'm sorry, smartphones and PCs, both through gaming and both through gaming well. There's some great smartphone games that I've sunk, hours into, but they do them very differently. But it doesn't matter. Because people have figured out how to use, each platform correctly. But we have examples, like we have a handful of examples of what are starting to be good or really great games in VR, which have taken several years to get to, that work on these 6DoF, head and hands, high-end headsets. So Quest finally brings that. And so that means that Quest will be able to do everything, whatever is already good about Gear VR and Go, whatever nice use cases there are there that are working for people, it'll be able to do that, plus a lot of the more interactive, immersive stuff that we get out of these high-end headsets. And I do think that that will be a shift. I do think that, especially at its price point, there's a lot of potential there. You can imagine something like Beat Saber, which I'm sure this, you guys have heard this a lot or thought about this as well, but Beat Saber is a game that the graphics don't really matter, right? What matters is the way that it makes you move and the way that it makes you feel. And the only reason that it can make you move and feel like you do is because it can track your head and hands in 6 degrees of freedom. If that can be brought to something like Quest, I've been saying this for years. If that can be brought to something like Quest, which is $400, if somebody plays it and they have fun, and everybody, literally everybody I've put into Beat Saber has come out and said that was really cool. If somebody gets into a headset, a Quest, plays Beat Saber, takes it off, it's the first time they ever played VR, and says that was really fun. How much does that cost for me to do that? The answer used to be like $1,500 if they didn't already have a gaming PC, which is not most people. The answer after Quest launches, assuming Beat Saber ends up on it, will be $400, maybe less in the near future. And that is a price point where people start to say, huh, $400. That was fun. You know, I'm going to think about that. You know, maybe it's not an instant purchase, right? For some people, maybe. But maybe it's not an instant purchase, but it's not like, oh, $1,500. Yeah, okay, whatever. Like it's not that throwaway number. So to go back to take this way back, I think that there is a good chance that Go ends up being influential because it brings the best parts, the key parts of high-end VR to more portable, more usable, and more affordable package. And that's what VR really needs. I mean, talking about consoles, Nintendo has been, you know, the best one to show that you don't need to be the most powerful console on the block. You have to have great content that people love in order to, you know, sell products and have loyal fans. Yes, I think Quest could be a big deal. It's not gonna blow the doors open. We still need a couple killer apps. But it could really drive interest and engagement and sales and continue to make this ecosystem really happen. As long as that ecosystem keeps getting built, VR is going to, you know, come one way or another.
Yeah, I think another huge element is exactly the audience that each device is trying to attract. Like, I think the audience that Magic Leap is trying to attract compared to Quest is like completely different, right? Even though we can consider them part of the same spectrum or in the same industry, but it's such a different strategy to who you want to be attracting. And even just within a year, right, that price point of playing Beat Saber is going to go from $1,500 down to $400. And there's enough games that are called console sellers that people are see gifs of the game and they're like, I want to play that game, and they drop, you know, $300 or $400 on buying a bundled version. I think that could happen with Go. But I guess the one thing that I guess I haven't been in agreement with, like, the rest of people that I've seen in the industry is people are like, the Quest will come out and it will sell 4 million headsets or 2 million headsets. Like, So I don't think that the Quest will not sell well over time, but I don't see the launch of it really being like a pivotal moment, especially in the gaming side, because gamers, even though like these headsets, especially the lower end headsets, are being marketed towards gamers, gamers are still not convinced that VR is very much a part of gaming's future. We're starting to see little shifts of that, and you can track this by seeing how many VR gifs are trending on like our gaming, and it's always in the comments. You'll notice is people being like, wait, this is what VR is like, and it's typically prompted because of the rich social interactions that people are having, whether you're like pulling someone's clip out of their gun, or like they're playing Russian roulette and they like do a dab before they kill themselves. Like, there's just like these interactions that you can't have in typical video games that I think are going to be the selling points. And so that's the reason why I think Quest will do well over time, when people keep seeing content about Quest keep coming up rather than the initial launch of it. Do you think that's like an accurate analysis, or?
Yeah, I do. And I think anybody who's been in this industry for, you know, several years now understands, you know, is more realistic about the expectations. The industry was definitely caught up in a, you know, really exciting, you know, this is going to be an immediate brand new industry. It's going to change the world. And all that will come in time. But the timeline that a lot of people were suggesting was incredibly aggressive. Yes, it will come, but people were really prone to start comparing VR to the iPhone, right? Because the iPhone's an example of a technology which very quickly integrated itself into our lives and really changed the way that people interact and with people in the world. So people said, okay, VR is even, you know, more powerful than an iPhone, so of course it's got to just take off. But the fact of the matter is, the iPhone didn't come out of a vacuum, right? There were you know, decades of devices that led up to it. And before the iPhone, which, you know, you can call the modern smartphone, there were years of smartphones before that that were figuring out how to do it all, figuring out what kind of applications you'd want on a phone. Years and years and years before we had that one product that had a broad appeal. And I think VR is, I think rather than, you know, looking at the iPhone, which is very nearsighted, you have to respect those decades and then years building up to that device where there was so much learning, so much development that had to come first before everything could get packaged together. And so we're seeing that now. You know, I don't think that we started in the iPhone era like some people would say. You know, we started back in that kind of really early smartphone days where all the interfaces on smartphones were different. All the applications were different. We were still using weird inputs and all this stuff that were ultimately not what we were going to use in the end. And yeah, we're there. We're figuring out what kind of applications work well in VR, right? As we're sitting here recording a podcast in VR, how does the input work? As we're talking about, you know, which devices and which input are critical, and what kind of things are useful as we have our screens here in front of us, you know, to potentially be using as we talk. So we've figured this out over the last couple of years. Applications like Big Screen have been built over the last couple of years. Just figuring out how to make the interface feel good, like, it just takes time. It's just not going to be an overnight thing. Quest will be in the same, Quest and AR for that matter, are going to be in the same boat. And so yeah, fundamentally, I agree. I don't think that Quest is likely to quickly sell multiple millions in year one. I absolutely don't. That will come when you have one product that is really easy to do, really easy to use, and does a ton of useful stuff for people. You know, gaming is one thing, right? You still need more useful applications that are easy to use to have that product that just everyone says, oh my God, I want that, I need right. that.
Because people don't just buy PS4s and Xbox Ones for gaming, right? Like, they buy it as a Netflix machine, as a YouTube machine, as there's other byproducts that come from these devices that are sold as a gaming device. And I think VR has the benefit of that as well, but except you could actually have the Netflix TV on your wall, you know, lying down, and I mean, and friends, and I don't know. There's a lot of really interesting opportunities that come as well.
Well, I'm kind of in between both of you. So, in a sense, what Azad said in the beginning of this topic, you know, the Quest will not sell immediately well, but later on. I can imagine this happening because I guess everyone who is really enthusiastic about VR already has either an Oculus Rift, or, you know, maybe they saved some money and got a mixed reality headset. You know, you need less GPU power, so maybe a 1050 Ti laptop would be fine enough. So, I mean...
Young people don't have enough money for it.
That's true. But again, I think there is one fundamental factor that could change this reality, and that is marketing spent on selling the Quest. I think if Oculus, actually, when they release the Quest, will do a huge campaign, like not the one that they did with, you know, the Oculus CV1, where they did like a little bit of YouTube advertising, but where they really will, you know, game up their advertisement and really, really go for it. I think they can very well sell a lot of those devices, particularly because, I mean, a lot of people are doing more and more pornography, for example. I meet a lot of startups, and particularly the older industrial people who I meet on different events are always kind of asking about, you know, but can you actually watch porn with it? And I mean, it's not something I'm super interested myself in, because I don't think porn in VR makes too much sense, in a sense that I understand why people enjoy it more than, you know, just watching it on the screen. But, you know, people ask for it and they have a demand. And if Oculus will spend really a lot of money on advertisement, like if they could build up a hype like Magic Leap, I think it could, you know, I think it could actually, you know, do some really well numbers. I'm not sure if they're going to do it, but
yeah. Yeah, no, that's a perfectly good point. Facebook could pay a lot to get these devices sold, right? So yes, that's the wild card variable. If they're going to go all out and try to get these out there, I mean, look at PSVR, expensive device, clunky compared to what Quest will be like, and they sold 1 million, I think, in less than a year. You know, they have the install base, you know, of, you know, at the time, I think it was something like 50 million PS4s and that built in, you know, pretty cohesive, loyal fan base to advertise to. So they had that marketing advantage. So yeah, we could see a million plus. But to Oz's point, it's not going to be probably the breakout product unless we end up with a killer app that really justifies the price point. But back to that point of the device doing multiple useful things beyond just gaming. Again, looking to the smartphone, if you want to compare it to a smartphone, the smartphone didn't just do calls. It was web browsing. It was maps. It was games.
Especially maps, right?
I mean, if you just look at the number of gadgets and gizmos that our smartphones replaced, I mean, a voice recorder, a camera, freaking tape measure. you can just keep rattling those off, the things that we don't buy anymore because it's in this one device. That is value like packed into that little box. VR will sell to tons of people when it starts replacing those devices, right? Or if there's some killer app that's going to appeal to a specific audience like gamers.
Sorry to interrupt you, but how could it? And I'm asking a question because I can totally easily, without even, drinking a coffee and being fit, imagine how an augmented reality device that is like, in 20 years will come out. That could totally replace a lot of values that a smartphone does. I totally can understand how a VR headset can give a certain benefit for certain industrial cases or medical cases. But how could actually, and I'm really curious about what you think about, how could a VR headset improve the everyday life of an average consumer? Where do you see actually stuff that they could actually really do productively or, interestingly with it?
Sure. So just one off the top of my head that I think is interesting is exercise, right? You can play Beat Saber for an hour a night, and that's not a bad workout at all. For people who don't already own or don't have room for, an exercise bike or something like that. I mean, honestly, there's a future, I think, where there are applications, especially once Quest is here, where you can track head and hands, where there are applications that can be tailored specifically toward exercise and could potentially replace some exercise equipment, nothing else. And then there's the things like 3D modeling, and this does go a little bit more into the enterprise end, you're right, rather than just the pure in-home consumer. So to your point, though, that AR might be kind of a better fit for replacing certain things, I agree, but only to the extent that AR and VR are separate, which, I mean, they don't need, there's no reason they need to be. So you can do some pass through, AR is totally viable on VR headsets today and will become increasingly more so. But actually I agree. If we're just going to separate AR and VR, I think AR probably has the potential, to be more of the useful device where VR would be more of the entertainment device for the end consumer. But ultimately, I think it's going to be a bit of a mishmash of those things.
Yeah, I think AR is something we should dive into in just a little bit because I want to ask about PC VR and about generation 2 of PC VR. This is something that since the CV1 launch, we're already thinking about when are the headsets that are going to come out with eye tracking, with wider field of view, higher resolution, and we're starting to see. The Android versions of this, like the Pimax 8K or 5K display. I got to try out the Star VR 1 with the extremely wide field of view, which I thought was very impressive. I would call the Star VR 1 probably the first of the second generation VR PC VR headsets. Do you think, first of all, do you think Oculus is going to make a Rift 2 based on the Half Dome prototype, which I think is still an open question whether it makes sense for them to keep investing in PC? And second, when do you think a second generation of PC high-end PC VR headsets will come out, and what do you think are the criteria for a second generation headset? Does it need to have eye tracking, high res? I'm doing fingers and counting on my fingers. Eye tracking, higher resolution, and wider field of view. And are there other like sensors or things that it would be included that we're missing?
Yeah, I think it's easy to kind of get tied up in the specs when thinking about second generation, and also thinking that it's always clear cut, which I just don't think it is. So. There are some headsets out there that have aspects of them that you would say this feels second generation. But as far as kind of listing off the specs, I don't think of what makes something a second generation PC VR headset. I don't think you can do that until they're out there. Then you can look back and say, oh, it turns out these specs are what we feel like is a second generation headset. I think the only way that you can really answer that question is to look at the experience that it provides. And is it fundamentally different than what came before? So Pimax, for instance, yeah, it's got a real wide field of view, but does it, you know, does it make other sacrifices that diminish the overall experience? And that's just an example. I don't know. StarVR 1, for instance, same thing, wide field of view. They've got eye tracking in there, but does that all work together in a cohesive way that really makes it a different experience than using what came before? Price factors in there as well. So looking back again, and unfortunately, the smartphone is just such a great place to draw analogies to. Moving from the iPhone that didn't have GPS to the iPhone that had GPS is a fundamental difference in experience. It could do things that were new and useful that the other one couldn't do. And again, you at the time the GPS was added to smartphones, it's like, great, now we'll be able to have our little Garmins on our phone. Nobody understood at the time what GPS in a phone and precision location would mean for enabling all of these geo-specific applications. Nobody knew it. So we couldn't just look at the specs and say, okay, second-gen smartphone is going to have GPS in it, right? We could look back and see that now. But that's to the point. I think you want to look for what is the experience that the specs are actually offering the user, and does it let them do different things, or does it really mark a shift in what their experience right. is like?
So you're saying it's retroactively only kind of implied. But yeah, go for it.
One thing with the GPS, though, I mean, most phones, in most of the cases, do not really so much rely on this GPS that we are used so much in the garments and all the navigation, but actually on a GPS. So actually the triangulation of the cell towers. So it's kind of a hack. So in a sense, a lot of things that we are used to with smartphones, like, you know, beautiful photos, they're a hack. It's all computational photography where, you know, crazy stuff is faking a lot of stuff that we are used to see out of good cameras. And with GPS in phones, I think, I mean, it's kind of interesting.
Why does that matter, though?
I think
it matters. It doesn't matter how it's done.
I think it matters through the fact that, for example, when we think about location-based services, like, it's still to this day super hard to actually do something where certain applications or certain things will trigger in a certain space on the phone, because the phone knows its precision outside of buildings well, but for example in buildings it's hard. But suddenly something like IRKit came along, and suddenly you can navigate very well indoor, and a phone can understand its place very well indoor, but it has nothing to do with GPS. So I think the problem is not that you need to look at the specs. The problem is that we need to figure out the use cases, and then we can hack around whatever technology we have and make it somehow happen. So the specs alone don't bring much, I think, in a sense, right?
So yeah. I'm gonna push back on this. I think I get your point in terms of, like, it's hard to make a criteria and be like, if it reaches this criteria, then automatically it's in a second generation and it's like a pivotal moment in that line of things. But however, you know, smartphones are very iterative, and technically we still consider them different generations every time. There's, you know, we went from iPhone 3 to 4 to 5, whatever. But I think eye tracking is enough of a shift on fundamentally both on how you use the device and how the device kind of, you know, fits around you, both in comfort, in, you know, automatic IPD adjustment, which StarVR had, with social environments, with even interacting with you know, game worlds, or, you know, you're probably going to see a lot of games that you will aim with your eyes, which you can imagine how esports will change, where suddenly, like, that we'll get to even faster movement and like, what is it, DPS? Not DPS, that's damage per second. It's like, how many, there's a metric for how fast you can type in, like, League of Legends or something. DPI, I guess. But when you have that with your eyes, you can imagine suddenly the esports players are training their reaction times, their fastest reaction time, which is, like, eyes. I think eye tracking really will market,
yeah,
pretty big shift.
Yeah,
but that's not coming on mobile just yet, right? Like that's for yeah. mobile, it's like at least four years away, and probably two why? Years for PC.
Why is it harder for mobile? Because the chip itself doesn't use that much currency, and if you can put it in a desktop headset, it's also very easy to integrate in a mobile headset where you have even less calculation of power that you really need. So foveated rendering makes even more sense for mobile, doesn't it?
Agreed, but I mean, I would think that too, but none of these new all-in-one headsets aren't have included it, so it's clearly there's a reason there.
Yeah, I think it's an element of the processing power required and the bandwidth. So you have to have cameras looking at the eyes, and you need to process those images rapidly and quickly to understand what the eyes are doing. And that's all computer vision stuff, which is pretty heavy processing-wise. So I think it's a matter of power consumption and processing power over cost or size. But you know, in the future, we could see dedicated chips built into some of these mobile platforms that all they do is those calculations, which could make that feasible. Whereas right. today, trying to run those images into you know the GPU and the CPU of the system would be prohibitively expensive from a processor standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. Is like it's still a lot of VR things are still hacks on top of already existing hardware, and until we have dedicated hardware for whether it's you know running at constant 90 or 120 FPS, or running your doing eye tracking and or even SLAM, right? Like SLAM being having its own dedicated processing unit does change things.
Yeah.
So just to reiterate, like, do you think there will be a Rift 2? And if so, when do you think that would be a thing?
Sure. I do think that there will be a Rift 2. I think that maybe if Facebook had kind of formed their own internal VR division from the start and started making products like Go and maybe had done a Rift initially, that maybe they would say, all right, PC VR is kind of too expensive and we're not going to do it. But I think the fact that they had a kind of acquired Oculus as this core, which you know arguably has been assimilated into the Facebook at this point, I think that there's still that core of people in Facebook who are in important enough positions and are excited enough about what you know PC VR can do that other platforms can't today. That Rift 2 is kind of an inevitability. There would have to be something drastic that happens to kill that from happening. I mean, I think if you just look at, you know, Michael Brash, Oculus's chief scientist, gives a yearly kind of presentation at their conference. He looks at kind of the state of the research and the near future of where he thinks the technology is going. And there's just a certain enthusiasm and passion there. That I think, you know, he's probably on occasion showing this stuff to Zuckerberg, who's you know one of the you know top stakeholders for Facebook, and is really driving these decisions. I think that someone like Michael Brash can convince someone like Zuckerberg that continuing to do Rift is important. To that end, when Oculus has said in the past nothing before either 2019 or 2020, and I imagine that that's still where it'll fall, which was really interesting because at the time when they had said that, I think that was either at or around the time of the CV1 launch, which was kind of early 2016. For them to come out and say, we're not planning another headset until 2019 or 2020 felt so far away, right? Yeah. But it's looking like that was a pretty good decision from the start. The Rift appears to still be going strong. They've been focusing on just making content on the PC side that works well for it. And, you know, some of the best VR games that we've seen to date have come directly as a result of them funding that content and having a platform saying, you just need to build it for this one and try to make it great. You know, I'm not a big fan of the exclusives and the politics, but it's actually very challenging to make, today a VR game that works great on 5 controllers and, touch controllers because they're actually very different. It would be like trying to make a game that works well on the Wiimote and on an Xbox controller. I mean, just to get the button setups correct would just be a big challenge. So being able to optimize for one platform instead of having them introduce a Rift 2 2 years later that does all this different stuff, it kind of seems like that was the right choice, even though it felt so far away when they said it at the time.
Do you think that the reason why they potentially assume that they need 4 years is that, let's say with the phones, again, the phone analogy, to iterate phones is kind of not that hard because you usually have like 2 to 3 years before you do a major design. So why are you improving a little bit the design of a phone like you have usually with iPhones or the Samsung phones? They kind of look similarly for 2 or 3 years. They just, you know, bump up the specs, do features, and in the meantime doing a completely redesign. And Oculus was like, yeah, we cannot like, you know, do 10% more pixels next year. Doesn't make sense. Why should we do it? We just wait till we have a completely new redesign. So there is not a possibility right now for such a pace as with smartphones. Is it something that you would agree with? Or
yeah, there's no competition. I mean, there's no rush even. Yeah.
So, I think in the modern smartphone era, the post iPhone era, that's when we got used to a 1 year refresh on the device that, you know, we all now have in our pockets because it's important. We want that pace because it's so useful to our lives. Before that modern smartphone era, if you go back to kind of the pre smartphones, your Blackberries, your Palms, your Trios, I'd honestly have to go back and double check, but they were, I don't believe that they were nearly as aggressive on this. Okay, here's the next year's model.
Right.
There wasn't that need at the time. It wasn't so useful that it had to be faster next year because the applications are growing at such a rate. I think that VR headsets are still in that phase where until there are enough new things to completely change the experience, I think it's a reasonable decision to say let's wait and not go through the complexity of making, you know, a brand new product essentially. To that point, you know, I'm wearing a Vive Pro right now. The resolution's better, which is awesome. But could I not be doing this in a Vive original launched 2 years ago? No, there's no reason I couldn't do that. So, you know, for a company like Facebook and Oculus who are playing a long game where they want to own the software, totally different decision than a company like HTC who, you know, they're making money off the hardware. So they want that pace. Oculus and Facebook don't necessarily need that pace. They're both valid for the situation that these companies are in.
Right. And last, I think, final question on VR before we kind of transition into AR stuff. It seems like Valve, being in the position that they are on the computer, they knew Steam VR was going to be the clear... Like, at least that's the sales were going to, a lot of VR sales were going to go through Steam, even with the Rift supporting like OpenVR. And like, I use most of the time I'm using Steam VR with my Rift. But does it make sense for them, and they haven't said anything, but like, are they thinking about mobile VR at all, or do they even care? Or is that too hard of a new market for them to go into? And especially because Oculus realized they're not going to make money off of home, like significant amount of money for Facebook, right? So they're like, we need to own. They've always wanted to own an entire platform. They missed the shift to mobile hardware. They tried to do a Facebook phone once, didn't really work. They've always been an app. Now they want to own either AR or VR, and it makes sense for them to have a close mobile ecosystem. But is Valve just chilling on their throne, you know, on PC, and they're like, we're just always going to target PC VR, high-end VR, and not need to worry about all-in-one?
That's a really good question that I don't hear asked a lot. So I think that Valve is unique because of the situation they're in, which they are a massive company, massively influential in the gaming space, but they're privately held. Their decisions are very different than you might see from a, you know, public company. I think, and I'm just guessing, I don't have any good indicators on this kind of from inside Valve right now. But my feeling would be that kind of the guys in there working on this stuff are real users and also kind of geeky techie nerds like, you know, probably the rest of us right now. I think that they probably see the difference in experience between what mobile VR has been able to do to date compared to, you know, the vastly different, in many ways, better experience that the high-end stuff does. And I think that they're probably spending a lot of their time working on that high-end stuff because it's what they're most interested in. Yes, Facebook can make the case for mobile will sell, a lot more. So let's start selling the Go and let's get that out there, even if it doesn't necessarily excite and energize the people who are literally in the room working on it. I think Valve is unique in that the people who are working there and the way their company is structured can say, this is what interests me the most. I want to build for this. And it's where we think we can do kind of the best work. I could see them saying, mobile is just not our specialty at all. They've been a PC, even long before working on PC VR, they've been a PC software company and game developer with PC tools for their entire history. So yeah, I
Right.
think it would be kind of I think it would be a big shift and challenge for them. It would require probably lots of new hiring and new, kind of a shift in their company to go after mobile hardware and mobile ecosystem. So I don't think that they're focusing on that. But the big question is, once Quest is out there and it's starting to really match the capabilities of input capabilities and the kinds of games that can be played, it really might start to interest them. So I don't know if they'll just be out forever, but right now I have no indication that they are really thinking much about mobile at all.
Right. And if they were to, I can imagine them doing something like a Steam box where it's still fundamentally like access to the same games and library and even the OS, but it's maybe we have to wait a few years for like the 855 or the 865 to come around, match exactly the same specs as a low-end PC VR, and then have access to the same app store. Maybe that would make sense. But to them, yeah, they still know what they're making money off of, which is Steam. They don't need to fragment that at all. Cool. Okay, let's start talking about augmented reality. And it this doesn't I want to include within that like pass-through stereo AR, which I think a lot of people aren't thinking about the impact that that can have, or even the quality of experience. But I guess let's just give you the stage to talk about Magic Leap. Like, what do you think? How would you analyze the situation with the Magic Leap 1, where it fits into the continuum? How the developers that you've been talking to have been responding to it, and is the what market do you think really makes sense for Magic Leap?
Sure. So I was just down at LeapCon the other week and got to kind of see what the company, how the company is presenting themselves. So let me back up just first, just to kind of address the device and all that stuff. So although they definitely kind of built their own hype bubble, which was burst for a lot of people, still fundamentally a good device. There are moments where using it does feel a little bit like magic when the content's all designed just right. To avoid, the limitations that come with a device like that, it can be really cool to be like, that thing looks like it's on my table. It looks like it's right there, right? That's the magic part. The leap part is the other question. The leap's not there. The company is still, I think, really promising things that they're not quite ready to deliver, just in terms of, how transformative they want to be and all that. But that's fine if they're looking to the long-term future. But I think that they need to be a little bit more responsible in conveying this to developers and users, being like, hey, this is, 10 years out, you might have this awesome device that you're going to wear all day and is and can do this stuff just all the time that you don't doesn't bother you to wear it and is affordable. But that's not this year and that's not next year. Magic Leap, they're kind of presenting themselves as a consumer company, just the way that they are talking and LeapCon, very shiny graphics, very pretty presentation, but they're still selling what is it's a developer kit. It is a development kit. They're calling it they occasionally say Creator's Edition, but I don't think they've ever called it a development kit, but that's what it is. And I think that there's no reason they shouldn't be honest about that. It costs $2,400. It's not a consumer device, but they're just treading this weird line where it's like they won't say that, right? They won't say that it's not a consumer device, even though anybody who's actually paying attention knows that it's a dev kit. So that's kind of weird. But they seem to be needing to run on this hype that they've built. And I get that they've raised a ton of money. They have to sell a vision in order to be successful. If they just stopped and said, here's our dev kit, 10 years later, you'll have the thing we've kind of been promising this whole time. That's going to kill their momentum. And they're still a startup. They're massively funded, but they're still a startup. Their continued existence is not guaranteed. So back to your question about kind of where Magic Leap fits as a device. It's also kind of weird because they're really pushing it as kind of this entertainment machine, which entertainment and somewhat productivity machine, which it has to be for now because it's a device that you can wear kind of comfortably for sessions, but it's still not a device that you are going to wear all day or even outside the house, really, which is where AR ultimately needs to end up, because AR's usefulness is being there always. It's not about walking over and pulling the thing out of the box and putting it on your head and booting it up and starting into a thing. That is massive friction that will never justify lots of AR's most useful use cases. And one that I think about all the time is my grocery list. So like right now I have a grocery list that's on my phone. And when I go to the store, I walk down the aisle, I get out my list, say, okay, what am I looking for? Tomatoes. All right, put it away. I go and I walk down, I grab the tomatoes, I get it out, I check it off, I look at the next thing. It's a bit of a clunky thing, but it's a useful tool. But when the time comes that I have these glasses that are comfortable to wear all the time, that nobody thinks look goofy enough, so I can wear them in the grocery store, and my list is just floating right there that I can glance at, walk down, get the next thing, it pops up, I just touch it to check off that thing. When that's the kind of use case that is like what I'd call like stupid simple. Like, it's almost like you don't even think, why would you, you'd never buy, obviously, a $2,400 product for that. But it's those little productivity use cases in your day-to-day that will be super useful that our smartphones work for today, but only because they're always in our pocket, and they're always on, and they boot up in a millisecond, the second you hit the button. AR has this huge potential to radically integrate itself into our day-to-day. But we're really far away from that today with Magic Leap. It's going to be years and years and years until we have that always worn device. But there's, so to back up a little bit, those AR use cases, VR is still really for a long time probably going to be the thing you want for entertainment. It's just a matter of physics and the way that the optics work and the way that AR displays work today. Mean that it's just a subpar visual experience to be using AR for times when you want to be fully immersed and entertained. So even at that point, I think pass-through VR is probably going to be kind of the superior experience. If you're doing an in-home session-based thing, you're going to want the thing that looks the best because you have to put on the headset anyway. You're not taking it everywhere. AR really finds its usability in the always worn, not necessarily pure entertainment, but kind of augmenting life type scenarios. And we're still pretty far from that.
Yeah, I do want to put the point out there that I think the AR features of VR headsets will be essential to future headsets, because us being so blind in our rooms, not knowing where our TVs and monitors are, and crashing our controllers, these are huge usability problems, right? That these aren't features of the headset. So us scanning the room, knowing where you are, knowing where people are, and like having that pass through is absolutely going to be is a usability thing that will have to be integrated. So yeah, I think I agree with your analysis at that point. I guess maybe coming back to the question of audience for AR and what, so VR is able to survive up until now because you have enough incentives both on the enterprise side where it's made certain things cheaper and faster iterations, and also there's enough PC gamers out there that had enough money to have good GPUs and play these games, right? Even though it's a very small market and some would say it's like very subsidized market, but it was enough to keep this momentum going so that we can get to generation 2 and 3. AR is kind of harder to think of what that right audience is, and perhaps HoloLens, at least from my perspective, did it right with really targeting enterprise, even though the field of view and experience of it isn't amazing, but you could do your enterprise-y things quite well. Magic Leap, as you said, is much more trying to gear towards consumers, where it's hard for me to like even imagine that working for the next 5 years, let alone like I've even heard from some enterprise clients complaining that because of the constriction of the field of view, the peripheral vision, right, is constricted because of the frame of the glasses to enable better user experience so that you don't notice the field of view limitations. That's a significant safety hazard when it comes to like you know, factories, and where basically all these augmented world expo, you know, the companies are, all these AR companies. And so it's hard to even see, maybe they're trying to do both, but like not doing each one well enough that both feel like they're not being targeted enough. I don't know. It's definitely a question of strategy, and I hope they're thinking it through, because there's very few of us out there, right? These people that are into these cinematic or game kind of weird experiences that want to put up with it. Peter or Ben?
Yeah, there's definitely a threat of trying to target both use cases and not doing one well enough. And to your point about the field of view being kind of a prime example of that, that could be an issue. I think that, like you said, Microsoft was smart to target enterprise because the experience isn't blow your socks off, like so immersive, so amazing. But as a tool, it doesn't need to be that way. It just needs to be useful. It just needs to provide value. And clearly, HoloLens seems to be delivering that. Where it ultimately ends up is kind of the broader question. It's great to have Magic Leap as a device out there. It's nice to have an option. It's great to have competition. I really hope that they manage to deliver the kind of amazing future that they're envisioning. It would be a shame if, you know, they've raised all this money and if all that work were to, you know, die at some point. That would be a terrible loss for the industry, regardless of what you think about the device or the company. I think that AR is a natural kind of future for smartphones, honestly. You know, I think in the long run it will replace the smartphone. The smartphone will probably become slowly turn into the compute unit that's in our pocket, as opposed to the thing that we're actually interacting with. It'll just be the battery, the processor, the critical, you know, processing information that's supporting a headset that we're wearing. That at a minimum, you know, you should just be able to hold your palm up flat and see a smartphone screen, right? That's the most basic kind of vision of AR taking over our smartphones. But at a maximum, blowing that whole smartphone screen up to your world basically is kind of that vision. And again, the needing to move toward the always worn or able to be worn outside in public for multiple hours at a time kind of device, it will take until AR starts really getting good in the consumer realm. In the enterprise realm, it can, you know, survive on a lot less. But I don't think it's going to really explode until we can get to that useful consumer space.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense if AR is very much a part of, is an extension of your phone, similar to how like AirPods are a very long lasting wearable device that is very much tied to your phone, and the experience is an augmentation of your phone, right? Being able to call up, hey Siri, on your eyes and in your ears without having to pull out your phone. And AR can be for sure an extension of that. I've always been bullish about, or maybe skeptical of, the argument that AR will replace phones, because we make this mistake where we think, you know, something new is coming out that is going to replace completely the older thing. Laptops never fully replace PCs. Perhaps in some situations they did, but they never fully, they both have their own paths, right, and their own use cases. Similar to phones, phones never fully killed PCs or laptops. They created their own use cases. TVs kind of fall, and radio fall in that spectrum of replacing in certain things, but not in all. So I guess if you want to be thinking realistically about it, you have to think about what kind of use cases does AR suddenly create where phones cannot do that thing, and you will have to use AR. But I think it makes sense if you think of like the Apple ecosystem and how well these wearables work together, from your watch to your AirPods to your phone, then glasses also make a lot of sense, and they have that infrastructure of developers that have been developing for years now with ARKit and understanding what can be done with it, that I think they're going to really set the pace when they do decide to come in.
I think that's a great point about whether or not one technology will just totally replace something else. I agree with you there. I mean, even in the gaming world, right? VR is probably not going to replace traditional gaming, but AR does have that. It's about extending the useful stuff that our smartphones can do out of the little triangle. But to your point about it not completely replacing it, there's still a big input problem. You know, I don't see us walking around hand gesturing all day, especially for entering text. I don't want to be inputting text with a gaze-driven cursor or with voice command when I'm out and about. I mean, you know, using Siri in public is awkward as it stands, but trying to use that to send texts, if you're sending, you know, 10, 20, 30 texts, you know, in a few hours, it's just, I don't think it's very viable. And yet the smartphone keyboard is a surprisingly functional input device, even if not as quick as, you know, full-size real keyboard. It's much better than this, you know, touch with virtual fingers onto a virtual keyboard, and arguably better than voice input when you're trying to use it in public. So I think that if nothing else, the smartphone could continue to be the input device. We might pull that out and you hold it, you know, you've got your augmented screen here, but you see just a keyboard on your smartphone screen and you're inputting text as needed into the augmented window. So there's and this is all far future stuff. This is 10, 20 year stuff where AR really blows up our smartphone into and integrates it into the world around us. In the near future, I absolutely agree. I don't think AR is in you know, the next 5 years going to be replacing smartphones or anything like that. I think it's that far future where it kind of starts to meld into this glasses plus compute plus compute and input device kind of in our pocket. And that's pretty, you know, when you put on Magic Leap or when you put on HoloLens and you see that thing that appears to be sitting on your table, and you just think, you know, just kind of imagine it is a pretty awesome, interesting future to see what that could mean once the hardware is able to get where it needs to go. The key to getting there is making sure enough people understand that vision and that magic, if you will, to continue working on the hardware to know what could be unlocked in the future. And hopefully that's a role that, you know, companies like Magic Leap can play by spending the money that they have raised to sell people on that vision.
Yeah, they need to treat their developers very nicely. Like, that's, you know, Oculus has been able to survive on PC because even though they've been seeding the content, but like you need to treat developers really, really well. They're going to be the only life force that's going to keep that momentum going. And perhaps not being the most truthful about the display technology or specs is kind of not great. We have an episode coming out next week about just looking at the display technology that Magic Leap has produced versus what they've been talking about, and even the marketing material and what that's based off of. Apparently, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what they've been working on internally was a lot more advanced than what they, you know, licensed and produced for the Magic Leap 1. And it's like, I don't know. I was very excited about the display, just like how good the accommodation support was going to be. And that was the one thing I wanted to look. And it really is like similar to what I've seen before, which is a fixed focal wavelength waveguide. Unless you have a question, Peter, we're running short on time. One last burning question that I haven't been able to get any good answers from anyone in the industry as, what is Google doing these days? What, like, is Daydream a thing still? Are they like, do they care? Is Tiltbrush and Google Blocks alive? Like, where are they? Are they just going to sit it out for a few more years and see if things catch up, or what's going on?
Good question. I don't have super deep insight into kind of the internal structure of their teams working on this stuff. But my sense from everything that I've seen, and written about and all that is that I think that they're going kind of a little bit back to the drawing board in terms of R&D. So the good thing is they're continuing to hire, but a lot of the jobs it looks like they're hiring for are more of this R&D type roles as opposed to content, you know, creators, interface designers. A lot of those roles, those in software roles, those kind of on top of the tech stack roles, they hired many of, you know, over the last 2 years. But now it seems like it is moving back into this R&D thing. So it seems like they might be going back into a bit of hibernation and seeing what they can come out with on the other end. They had this vision where, you know, Daydream View, their first headset, was this device you could stick a smartphone into, and it was a nice little inexpensive smartphone VR headset. Their vision was that just like the Android phone, which is built on their software but made by many different companies, I think that their vision was that other companies would say, oh, we've got a Daydream View headset, and we've got a Daydream View headset. And they hoped that these companies would compete and bring different features to customers. That just hasn't really evolved. And from what I've seen, it seems like a big reason for that was Google hasn't been as good about attracting and keeping developers and content going. Their content is kind of, it's relatively good quality, but it's pretty sparse. And I haven't seen a lot of new compelling stuff recently. And that, I think, that's kind of a Google problem, more so than a VR problem. You know, I don't know that they were ready for the amount of support that they were going to have to kind of provide to get that ecosystem kickstarted. They were, I think, really relying on saying Daydream is going to be a big platform and it's on Android. And so our existing Android developers are going to be so excited. They're going to come start building for this because it's this new opportunity and it's directly tied into the Play Store, which has, you know, billions of users. Seemed like it was set up to just be this kind of instant explosion and hope that their developers who, you know, maybe were having a hard time making it in the saturated Play Store would start working on Daydream stuff. And it just seems like they've not really seen that happen in the way that they were expecting to. And I think they were setting up for a different kind of trajectory that they thought VR was going to go on. And now that hasn't exactly taken off, their stuff's still good, but they, I do think, are a bit going back to the drawing board in R&D. I don't think that they've given up on it by any means. I think it's still a very active area for them, but I think they're now looking forward to what's coming next.
Right. It seems like, or if you leave it to organic growth for VR on a mobile platform, it's like just not going to live by itself. And clearly with how much money Oculus has poured into keeping content coming, like it shows that that's really what's been the life of it. Life of VR for most part is like Oculus pouring millions into companies and content. And Google, I guess, doesn't have an incentive, right? They didn't spend $2 billion on a company and then have to, and they already own a platform. They own phones. They don't need a new, I mean, they want AR and VR to be an extension of it, but they don't have that incentive to have to own something.
Yeah, it's interesting because so many companies are looking at mobile as this future massive potential for VR, which it probably is, but it really feels a lot like the core use cases, the really great applications, the really great experiences are happening on the high-end stuff. And it probably makes sense because, you know, there's just simply more breathing room. You know, you can have better graphics. People are willing to pay more for the stuff. But to the people who are kind of discounting the high end just because it doesn't historically have the scale of mobile, I think it's a bit of a mistake for where we are in VR right now. I mean, it just feels like there's so much more rich engagement from people that I talk to who are playing games, who are doing stuff like big screen. And you know, it might not be quite as large, but you have to kind of look at the use cases, the use patterns, which seem so much deeper to me than what we're seeing on mobile. And so, as we were talking about earlier, hopefully Quest starts to bridge that gap. But I think there's lessons to be learned in what kind of things people are doing with the high-end VR stuff, and you know, although that was supported with, you know, a lot of kind of investment and subsidy, it's here, right? Like it's here. We're recording this podcast in VR. This is really incredible and it's really useful and it's providing us value. And as the hardware gets less expensive, if we can just offer up this ability to have an in VR meeting to people at the right price, that's a rich, useful, valuable application that somebody will be willing to purchase. And this works best with this hardware that we're using now that has these particular capabilities.
Yeah, it really makes sense. And if even though there are people still writing articles that, you know, is VR dying? And it's like either they're misinterpreting the data or just completely ignoring it. Like,
yeah,
there's clear growth, just not obviously at the rates that you see with other things. But that's how markets start, like this. And it's everything, every indicator of this market shows that it's quite a healthy growth. And if just because it's not the hype time right now means... it means you probably should be investing in it right now.
Yeah, like,
this is the right time to be in it. So,
if I was an investor, I would be all over VR right now because the hype's gone. The use cases have become more clear. It's more clear what kind of company can and will succeed, and the valuations are way more realistic. If you're an investor who's investing in the long run to find the companies that are going to be here 10 years, 20 years down the road, who are massive because they started, you know, they found the use case early and survived and continued to iterate on it. That's today you want to get in. You know, there's already been, you know, kind of a first wave of deaths, if you will, for VR companies that rose too big too fast. And now the second, you know, wave is kind of ready, and everything is clearer than before. It's, you know, people, it's not so much a dream and an idea. It's these real use cases. It's this, we've built this application. Here's how people are using it. And we start to look at that. That's where you start to get your answers about, you know, whether or not those applications or companies are, you know, have real legs.
Agreed. Ben, how can people find you, contact you, and how can people find out more about Road to VR?
Sure. We're at roadtovr.com, which is like a road that you drive on. So roadtovr.com is where we publish our news. I'm on Twitter at BENZ145 and usually ranting and raving about various VR design issues. Which I just throw out there in a vacuum, but sometimes have fun conversations with people. I am a real user of VR, which I think is an important part about my perspective. You know, outside of, if I wasn't writing about it, I would still be playing these games and poking around and seeing what's going on. And so I'm often there in kind of the nitty gritty saying like, this application's interface needs to be better. Or like, this application's interface is really good. Everybody should look at this. Look at these lessons. So I'm actively using, trying to make sure that I continue to be a participant and helping that to inform my perspective. So for anybody who's interested in those real user nitty gritty conversations, seek me out on Twitter. If you want the high level, what's happening, what's exciting, check us out on Road to VR.
Yes, big fan of your tweets. And yeah, I think it makes sense. It's very helpful, actually, to talk about very design-specific things because we're just not at the scale yet where these things come organically. So
it
makes sense. And we really like to concentrate on design as a big topic on this podcast. So great stuff there. And you can find the Research VR podcast on Twitter at ResearchVRcast. If you can consider supporting us on Patreon, that would be incredible. For as little as $2, half a cup of coffee in San Francisco is what you can get. It was for one a month. Unfortunately, Peter, I think they might have kicked him out of the Starbucks. They were closing down.
Sir, we can't be doing this in here.
Yanked him out of the Matrix. And yeah, thanks, Ben, again for joining us. This has been really great.
Thanks, Oz. I enjoyed it.
All right. And thank you all for listening. Goodbye.